Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Larry Lester.
And welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
All right, so I'm with Chet Wye, the Executive Director of Harlem for Obama. Please talk about your coverage as an organization for this particular election. I know this is not the first debate watch party. Talk about your involvement in Harlem for Obama and lead us up to tonight.
Well, Harlem for Obama was established actually in 2007, so we were one of the groups that helped put the president, when he was Senator Barack Obama.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host tonight for the Gist of Freedom, brought to you by, or produced by, Leslie Gist, author and historian. I'm stationed here in Kansas City, Missouri. I am the president of the Midwest Afro-American Genealogical Interest Coalition here in Kansas City. We meet the first Saturday of each month at 3720 Blue Parkway, in Kansas City, Missouri. So if you're ever in the area on the first Saturday of the month, drop in around noon and check us out. Major League Baseball is getting ready to start its annual World Series of Baseball, and tonight our topic is black baseball. Our special guest tonight is Larry Lester. Larry was one of the founders of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum here in Kansas City, Missouri. He served as the research director and treasurer for 5 years, between 1991 and 1995. He was very instrumental in the development of the museum's business plan and licensing program. He was responsible for acquiring rare artifacts from the families of Major League or Negro Leagues baseball players such as Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, Archie Ware, and others. During his tenure at the National League, or Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, he served as a senior editor of its quarterly newsletter called Silhouettes, its annual yearbook, Discover Greatness. He was responsible for putting together a traveling Negro Leagues exhibit that has been showcased each year at the Major League Baseball's Fan Fest during All-Star Week since 1993. He also developed a similar exhibit called Discover Greatness, which is owned by the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum and has been presented at various museums nationally since 1999. He left the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in 1995 to start NORTEC Research Incorporated, combining his expertise in research and technology to track the African-American experience. From 2000 to 2004, Lester was under contract with the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown, New York, to do a comprehensive study of African-American baseball from the Civil War up through the mid-50s, and it's appropriately called Out of the Shadows. In 2006, he served on the Special Negro Leagues Committee for the National Baseball Hall of Fame, and was responsible in selecting a record 17 new Negro League players, executives, and managers to that Baseball Hall of Fame. He's also been instrumental in securing retroactive Major League Baseball pensions for more than 85 former Negro Leaguers, while involving approximately 150 players in Major League Baseball Properties Royalty Program, from the sale of Negro League caps, jerseys, and related apparel in the 90s. Larry has written over 8 books on the subject of black baseball. He has written forwards to to approximately or over 100 books on African American history, which includes baseball, black baseball. He's also available for fee-based lectures, seminars, panel discussions, workshops, exhibit bookings, and our book signings. Are you there, Larry?
Yes, Preston. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule this time of year to be with us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
I want to get into this discussion here, but before we get into the development of the Negro Leagues, as we know that was established here in Kansas City in 1920, I want to go back before that and talk about the first known black baseball player in organized baseball, a gentleman by the name of Moses Fleetwood Walker. What can you tell us about Mr. Walker and some of the controversy around his life?
Well, Moses Fleetwood Walker started to play. He was the son of a African-American physician and a white woman. So he was a mulatto.
Okay.
Was well educated in Steubenville, Ohio, and attended Oberlin College. He also played baseball for the University of Michigan in 1882. From there, he went to play for a team called the Toledo Blue Stockings. The next year, the Toledo Blue Stockings entered the American Association, which was considered an official major league at the time, much like the National League and the American League. So with the Blue Stockings joining the American Association, he became the first African-American professional player by default with a major league team, the Toledo Blue Stockings. And he played on that team for 2 years until there was an unwritten ban against African-American ball players. Him and his brother, Weldy, played 2 years with the Toledo Blue Stockings. So Moses Fleetwood Walker deserves the recognition as the first African-American to break the color barrier in Major League Baseball. He was a barehanded catcher.
Did you say barehanded catcher? Okay.
Yes, he was quite the athlete.
Okay. And there was some other controversy going on in his life as well. He was an author, an inventor, and ran into a little bit of trouble there. Was it in Ohio?
Yes. He has several patents for the motion picture industry. And quite the inventor. He also received a patent for an artillery shell. You know, this is right before World War One.
Okay.
But he ran into some controversy when he, in Syracuse, New York, he was attacked by a group of white men, and he stabbed one of them. And the fellow died, and he was acquitted of murder later, a second-degree murder, and claimed self-defense. And he was acquitted by an all-white jury, by the way.
Right.
So he had a very controversial career, baseball-wise, as an inventor. He had a movie house in Steubenville, and you know, he had to deal with the criminal allegations. So he was quite the character, and I think David Zane put out a great book on Moses Fleetwood Walker. He was considered what we call a nationalist. He wrote a book called Our Home Colony. It talked about the Negro race in America. So he was also an author. So quite the American icon.
Okay. And there's some historians who would want to give the first black baseball credit to a gentleman by the name of William Edward White. What's your take on that controversy?
Well, William Edward White played one game in 1879 with the Providence Grays, which were part of the National League. He was a mulatto. father was white, and his mother was one of the owner's slaves. So by definition, he was a African-American. However, he looked white. He married into the white race. And on his census reports, he always listed himself as white.
Okay.
So despite claims by my good friend Peter Morris, great historian and researcher, I still consider Moses Fleetwood Walker as the first African-American to break the color barrier for the simple reason that William Edward White never had to battle racial discrimination. He was never had to suffer any of the atrocities of going places. He passed as white. He acted white. And so biologically, he may have been black, but professionally, he was a white man.
Okay. Well, moving on up to talk a little bit about your latest book, and that way we have to talk about Mr. Rube Foster. Is that book out yet?
Yes, my book on Rube Foster came out about 2 weeks ago. It's called Rube Foster in His Time, on the field and in the papers with Black Baseball's Greatest Visionary. A very long title, fitting for the greatness of this man.
Well, before you get into that, Larry,
yes.
The book is available from you. How will our listeners get a hold of a copy of that book right now?
They can just send me an email. My email is larrylester42@gmail.com.
Okay, and you have a website?
Yes, I have a website, LarryLester42.com.
Okay.
And they can reach me there.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Tell us a little bit about Rube Foster.
Well, Rube, for those who are not familiar with the name, was the founder of the Negro National League in 1920. He was an incredible pitcher before he changed his role to manager and owner of the league. Quite the entrepreneur that he dominated of us, Donald Trump, a narcissistic personality, but creative, a genius, a rolling memory, quite the icon. He should have burst in.
Larry, do you have a radio on?
No, I do not.
Give us some background feed. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, he was the, without a doubt, one of the greatest pitchers in the Negro Leagues. And the, as I mentioned, he started the Negro National League, the first all-black league to survive a full season. What is important to realize that the Negro Leagues were the third largest black-owned business in America at the time behind insurance companies and hair care products.
Wow.
So for that alone, we should recognize his contribution to American history. What else can I tell you about Rube?
Well, it started here in Kansas City, and I think I've heard something about Rube on the QT, was hired by Major League Baseball clubs to teach their pitchers how to pitch?
Well, that is true. John McGraw, manager of the New York Giants, hired him to teach Christy Mathewson how to pitch. Christy Mathewson is in the Hall of Fame, and Rube taught him the screwball, and for three straight years he won more than 30 games. Quite the talent. So racial discrimination, Foster's opinion to judge talent throughout his team.
Okay. And that was, he invited people here to Kansas City at the YMCA. They're located at 19th and Paseo, and that building is under renovation. Have you been involved in that project, which has been led by the barbecue king here in Kansas City. Are you involved in that project at all?
No, I'm not, Preston. I've reached out to Mr. Gates and let him know that I have plenty of memorabilia and historical documents I'd like to donate to the Buck-O-Neill Research Center. So hopefully they'll open up soon and I can make a contribution to them.
Yeah, he's really got that building looking great, and I would suggest that our listeners in the Midwest or you're traveling through Kansas City to stop and visit there at 19th and Visale when it opens. Also, check out the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, which is located at 1616 East 18th Street here in Kansas City, Missouri. And another benefit of visiting there, that right next door, is the Jazz Museum. A couple of things that Kansas City was very well noted for, besides steaks and barbecue, it was jazz and black baseball.
All right.
Yeah. Now, okay, so you've written over 8 books, attributed over 100 books. Tell us a little bit about the innovations that Rube Foster brought into the Negro Leagues. For example, the World Series was more than 7 games, the Negro World Series that was played starting in what year?
1924.
Okay.
What was unique about that is he believed in a 9-game series, the best of 9. And the World Series was played in 4 different cities, not just the between the 2 teams. What he was trying to do is get maximum exposure. And, of course, there were a few games played in his home city of Chicago.
Okay.
You know, much to everyone's grief. So, like I said, you know, Rube was an entrepreneur and a self-promoter. But he had a best-of-9-game series. It was played between the Kansas City Monarchs and the Hilldale Club out of Darby, Pennsylvania, a suburb of Philadelphia. And it was quite the World Series. One of my books is called Baseball's First Colored World Series, a 1924 meeting between the Hilldale Club and the Kansas City Monarchs. And it's probably, in my opinion, although it went 10 games, one game was called 13-inning tie because of darkness. In my opinion, it was the most dramatic as well as the most exciting World Series ever played. For the simple reason, each team reeled off 3 straight wins, 4 games were decided by 1 run, and 5 games were decided in the final inning. No World Series since 1924 has met that criteria. And that prompted me and encouraged me to write this book on the 10-game World Series. The book has play-by-play, which is not commonly available, the financial statements, a biography on each player that participated in the World Series, even a scorecard, grading each manager on how well he strategized the game in trying to win or lose, and I even name a most valuable player, so forth and so on. So the 1924 World Series was played here in Kansas City, in Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Chicago. Great World Series. Encourage everyone to learn more about it.
Yeah. Another great series that I've read about in your Black Baseball's National Showcase, the East-West All-Star Game. And you chronicle those games in a very complete manner from 1933 to 1953. And I was very intrigued in reading the book, particularly about the New York Cubans versus the Pittsburgh Crawfords, both teams of 1935, that there's a little bit of controversy on those two teams being the greatest black baseball teams of all time. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Crawfords were out of Pittsburgh, and they had a fantastic team with the great Oscar Charleston. Many people consider him the greatest all-around player ever in the Negro Leagues, and Cool Papa Bell and Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson and Judy Johnson an outstanding team, versus the New York Cubans, who also had a great team, many great teams. They won it all in 1947 with great ballplayers like Louis Tiant Sr., the father of Louis Tiant Jr., who pitched with Boston Red Sox. And they also had Minnie Minoso at third base and Claudio Duaney playing the outfield, and a fellow by the name of Rabbit Martinez, one of the greatest shortstops ever to play the game, played in more games than any Latino player in the East-West All-Star game, that is. Also had Martin DeHigo, the great Cuban outfielder and pitcher who could play all nine positions and who today is in four or five National Baseball Hall of Fames, outstanding ball player. So you have these great New York Cuban teams, and you also have the great Pittsburgh Crawford teams. Which one is better? Hard to say. I think it's a coin flip.
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned Oscar Charleston. I was reading Bob Motley's book, Ruling Over Monarchs, Giants, and Stars.
Mm-hmm. Which, great book.
Very good book. Chronicling his career as an umpire in the Negro Leagues and beyond. Just a forward by you and Diane Warwick, by the way.
Okay.
And in that book, I found this quote attributed to Frank Young, a sports writer for the Chicago Defender. And I quote, "The death of Oscar Robertson." Or Oscar Charleston, I'm sorry, I got basketball on the brain. "The death of Oscar Charleston removes from this green earth the greatest all-around Negro ball player of all times."
Right.
Yeah, that's a quote from Frank Fay Young, Chicago Defender.
Yeah, without a doubt, he's probably the greatest player, at least in players that I've interviewed who saw him play. He could hit, he could run, he could throw, he could hit for power, outstanding temperament, had the proper attitude to win, no-excuse type ball player, and had a long career and later managed.
Yeah, I recall Buck O'Neill saying that during an interview, a reporter asked him who was the greatest black baseball player. And Buck responded, "Well, I'm sure the greatest one you ever saw was Willie Mays. But the greatest one I ever saw was Oscar Charleston."
Yeah, that's right.
I want to pause here for a minute to let our callers know that they can reach or call in with a question or comment. Or if you have some memorabilia, if you are a descendant of one of the players from the Negro Leagues, give us a call here at 347-324-5552. Talk to us about some of the owners in the Negro Leagues, particularly Mr. Wilkerson here, who's the owner of the Kansas City Monarchs.
Well, J.L. Wilkerson was owner of the Monarchs, the longest-running franchise in Negro League history. Unlike most of the owners, J.L. Wilkerson was a white man. And in several interviews with players who played for him, they all voiced the same consensus opinion that J.L. Wilkerson was an honest man without a racist bone in his body. He always paid them on time. And they always traveled first class, whether it be in a Pullman coach bus or car or railway. He made sure they always had a suit from several of the stores on 18th and Vine. And he had a code of conduct for them to act properly on and off the field. And without hesitation, they always think of J.L. Wilkerson as an excellent leader, manager, friend, and in fact, he gave Buck O'Neill the down payment on his first house. Just an incredible man, and deserving of his 2006 induction into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. What is interesting about Wilkerson, when Rube Foster started the league in 1920, he wanted all owners to be of African-American descent. But he made an exception with J.L. Wilkerson because of his reputation, which was in previous years before 1920, he had a team called the All Nations team, and it was representative of all nations. They had Chinese players, a player from Filipino, another player from Japan, African-Americans, Cubans, and they traveled around the country, the Midwest, playing all comers, black, white, or whatever. And the All Nations team was a gate attraction because people wanted to see how all these nationalities meshed together and played great quality baseball. They had a pitcher by the name of John Donaldson who won over 300 games and routinely struck out 15 to 20 batters each game. So Jose Mendez, the great Cuban pitcher who was in the Hall of Fame. Hurley McNair, great outfielder. So J.L. Wilkerson had already laid the groundwork and provided credence to why he should be an owner in the first league to survive a full season.
Okay. You mentioned barnstorming. That was part of, it seemed like the guys in the Negro leagues and maybe in the major leagues as well, the white players, played baseball all year round. Puerto Rico and Mexico, and they would play each other. That is, I believe Satchel Paige put together an all-star team, and the Dean brothers put together a team. They would travel all around. So how did those contests go? Talk to us a little bit about those games.
Well, that was a great time for America because at the time, baseball was still segregated. So racism had entertainment value. Mm-hmm. So Satchel Paige put his team together, toured the country in 1934 against the Dizzy Dean All-Stars. And fans came out everywhere, sellouts everywhere they went, because people wanted to see an all-black team play an all-white team and see who was the best of the best. It was so successful that in 1946, Satchel Paige started up the All-Star teams again, and they toured the country against the Bob Feller All-Stars. Once again, sellout crowds everywhere they went. So that's the entertainment value of black versus white. Just incredible games. To read those newspaper accounts of Dizzy Dean and Satchel Paige playing against each other are incredible. In fact, Dizzy Dean said, if Satchel Paige and I were on the same team, we would win the pennant by the 4th of July and go fishing the rest of the season until World Series time.
About the 4th of July.
Yeah.
Wow. That's quite an endorsement.
Yes, it is.
Speaking of Satchel Paige, how did he get that name? His name was Leroy, wasn't it?
Yeah, Leroy Robert Satchel Paige.
So where did Satchel come from?
Well, there are many stories, but the one that we tend to agree upon, at the age of 7, Satchel got this job carrying suitcases at the Union Station in Mobile, Alabama, where he was from. And he devised this harness for hustling several bags at once, so he could carry, you know, 4 or 5 bags over his shoulder with this harness-type contraction. And someone looked at him and yelled, "It looked like a walking satchel tree." And so it kind of stuck with him. So he became Satchel. Not because of his big feet, as some people think.
Okay. And also, in going through your book on the East-West All-Star Game, another unique feature was that the Negro community, the black community, voted on the players that would appear in the East-West All-Star Game.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed Hilton Smith, a pitcher, usually garnered more votes than Satchel Paige did for those starting pitcher spots. So who was the best pitcher between Hilton Smith, who also pitched for the Kansas City Monarchs, and Satchel Paige? Any stats to separate the two or whatever?
Well, we do know that Hilton Smith won more games than Satchel Paige did when they were together with the Monarchs. Players tell me that Satchel Paige would pitch the first three innings, and then Hilton would come in. And they felt like if they didn't get to Satchel, then it was all over, because once Hilton Smith came in, there was no chance of them winning the game. You know, he had a Rolex fastball and a Cadillac curve. He had one of the greatest curves in the history of the game. I mean, I talked to his son, Mickey, today, this morning. But Hilton was the equal of Satchel Paige. But he was a man with a cool demeanor, kept to himself, very deeply religious man, and never promoted himself. And it took years before records revealed that he was one of the top pitchers in the Negro Leagues. Who was better? It's hard to say. There's only one Satchel Paige. And
he was quite the promoter, Satchel was.
Oh, yeah. He,
the self-promoter.
Exactly. He would shuffle along and promote himself, and he was notoriously late for many games, but that was all a way of promoting himself. He had the hesitation pitch, and, you know, he would name his fastballs and, you know, the blooper pitch and the dipsy doodle and what was that, the midnight rider.
Okay.
You could hear it, but you couldn't see it. And
yeah, I heard that quote, you can't hit what you can't see.
Right. So he was...
At that about Satchel.
Right, and he had his six rules, you know. Never look back. Something may be gaining on you. And never run, you know. But he named all of his pitches, you know, four-day rider, trouble ball, you know, whipsy-doodle, and step and pitch it, and which is really his hesitation pitch, and drop ball. And he had a B-ball. It'd be where he wanted to be. So he always kept people on edge. And of course, when they asked him when he was born, he would always tell them he didn't know. And he would say, how old would I be if I didn't know how old I was?
Mm-hmm.
So he kept the reporters on the edge of their seats and entertained them.
Larry, I had a question about other museums that might be available in the country. Are there any of the ballparks? But some of these owners, well, most of them rent it from the major leagues.
That's true.
Their stadiums. But I think that Pittsburgh have their own stadium. Of course, here in Kansas City, we played at the old Municipal Stadium, and before that it was the Muehlbach Park. And
right.
Several names. But do any of those, the Pittsburgh Crawfords, for example, I think the owner owned a nightclub and cafe in Pittsburgh called the Crawford Grill. Are any of those landmarks across the country still around that people could visit or whatnot?
Well, yes, the Crawford Grill is still around on Wiley Avenue in Pittsburgh. That's a historical landmark. Where all the great ballplayers met, owned by Gus Greenlee. Gus Greenlee built Greenlee Field in the 30s and installed stadium lights.
Hello.
Unique. You still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, and installed stadium lights, you know, years before Major League Baseball had installed lights at in their stadiums. So, Crawford Field is no longer around, or Greenlee Field, rather. But there was Martin Stadium in Memphis, Tennessee, owned by J.B. Martin and his brothers, B.B. and W.S., and, you know, they were all doctors, dentists, and pharmacists or whatever. That was a black-owned stadium, which had dormitory rooms underneath to allow ballplayers to live during the season. a very unique concept. So Negro League owners had their own stadiums in some cases, but in most cases they rented the parks from Major League teams, which is a myth that I need to correct. The Negro League teams played in the same stadiums as Major League teams. They played in Forbes Field in Pittsburgh, Griffin Stadium in Washington, D.C., Yankee Stadium in New York, Shaft Park in Philadelphia, and, of course, Mubok Field in Kansas City, Missouri. Played on the same field with the same equipment under the same rules. So despite what you may read that they played with inferior equipment and in band boxes or smaller parks, it's simply not true.
Okay. And they played, when they went barnstorming, would that include some of the southern cities and some of the cities in Mexico and Puerto Rico?
Barnstorming is unique. They tended to go to small towns because these towns were starved for entertainment. They would set up a ball field in a cow pasture or some farmland and build some bleachers or use a college field. So they would always have a big turnout because, you know, here comes the Monarchs. So teams across towns across Kansas and small towns in Missouri and Iowa and Arkansas saw a lot of the Kansas City Monarchs coming through. And sometimes barnstorming would include games played between the major league games against league games. So if you're going to Chicago by car or bus, you would stop off and play maybe in Des Moines, Iowa, before you got there. The Negro League teams did not play every day like Major League teams did. They usually played on the weekends to attract the biggest crowd. So their schedule was between 60 to maybe 90 games a year versus 152 games for Major League Baseball.
And the Negro leaguers were working full-time jobs, a lot of them.
Yes, in many cases, and some of them only played on the weekends, so, or what they call the maid's day off, which might be on a Monday.
Right.
They had to get people out to the ballpark, so this is why the Negro League started night baseball in 1930, because their fan base was the working class, and they had to get the working class out to the ballpark, which could only be at night. You know, after they got off the construction job, the cleaning job, the house cleaning job, they were ready for some entertainment. So, you know.
Okay. Talk to us about the women's presence in the Negro League, both on the field and in the owner's box.
Well, that's interesting. On the field, we had Toni Stone, who started her career with the Indianapolis Clowns in 1953, and then later went over to the Kansas City Monarchs. Her spot with the Clowns was filled by a pitcher, Mamie Peanut Johnson, and Connie Morgan, an outstanding basketball player out of the Philadelphia area. So these three ladies are pretty prominent in Negro League history. When Jackie Broverson broke the color barrier, and, you know, Toni Stone and Mamie Johnson and Connie Morgan broke the gender barrier in black baseball. They were pretty average ball players. Some of the players accepted them, others did not. Only Mamie Johnson is alive today. She lives in Washington, D.C. As far as the owners, there were several team owners. Olivia Taylor, who owned the Indianapolis ABCs, she inherited the club from her husband when he passed away. There was Henry Reen Proctor Green, owner of the Baltimore Elite Giants, and probably the most famous of all owners was Effa Manley, who owned the Newark Eagles and brought them to a championship in 1946 with a team that included Monty Irvin and Larry Doby. Effa Manley is the only female, black or white, in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Some controversy there, but Effa Manley is a well-known icon in Negro League history, and there have been a couple of books about her. Brian Motley, who you mentioned earlier, in his book, is working on a screenplay of Effa Manley's life. So hopefully he can get that funded, and we'll get to see Effa Manley on the big screen.
Oh, great. I might add, too, that Motley's book was co-authored with his son, Byron Motley. Great book. Parts of it brought me to tears, I must confess. Yeah, it did. It's a great book, great story of perseverance and the trials and tribulations he had to face to get done what he had to do in terms of being a umpire and trying to break into big-time baseball, the major leagues, then a family, working full-time at General Motors, hitting the road, going to all these baseball games, getting turned down from umpiring schools over and over and over. And he just hung in there. And quite a moving book. I would really suggest our readers look it up. Would that book be available down at the museum?
Oh, yes, of course. It's a book of perseverance. I love talking to Bob Motley about his road to greatness. He talks about going to umpiring school and how he got a perfect score and no one would hire him.
Nobody.
So he went back to advanced umpiring school and he got another perfect score and he still could not get hired. So it took a lot of guts, perseverance, and, you know, a steady aim at his goal to achieve that success. Wonderful umpire and a great man. Always
another
great
thing
talking
that
with him.
Reminds me, 60 years, he noted in his book that 60 years after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier as a baseball player, that 60 years later there were only two African-American umpires in Major League Baseball.
Is that right?
That's what I read in the book. And like I said, it's a very good book, and I would suggest our readers get into that. Speaking of Jackie Robinson, in Major League Baseball, from my research, I discovered there was a little bit of controversy back in the day as opposed to should we be sending individual players into the major leagues or should we be sending teams into the major leagues? Can you talk to us about that, or even if that was a controversy?
Well, it was. Rue Foster had for many years promoted sending an entire team into Major League Baseball. Of course, that never worked out because he died early in 1930. But it was just, based on my research, there was just too many great ball players to come in all at once. And so Jackie Robinson was chosen, although, let's say, he was perhaps not the greatest player from the Negro Leagues. He did have market value. And what many historians have failed to realize that Jackie Robinson was a household name long before he was signed in October 1945 by Branch Rickey. Jackie Robinson was a halfback for UCLA. And at the time, in the 40s, we find college football is the second most popular sport in this country. In fact, in October, when you go to the newspaper archives, you find college football on the front page and the World Series on the second page.
Okay.
So everybody in this country knew who Jackie Robinson was. He was not an unknown quantity. When we look at his track record, he was a lieutenant in the Army. He was in the process of marrying his college sweetheart, Rachel, a nurse. He was a non-drinker, non-smoker. You know, he had what we would say table manners, someone who had interacted with whites before. He went to an integrated school in Pasadena, California. And so he was ideal person to break the color barrier, where many of the other great ball players grew up in the South in segregated communities, went to segregated schools, and maybe they were not quite mentally fit to make that leap into integrated baseball. So I think this is why Jackie Robinson was chosen, same reason for Larry Doby coming in 11 weeks later. We look at a few days later, Hank Thompson and Willard Brown joined the St. Louis Browns, and they didn't last but 3 weeks. They just could not make the adjustment of traveling with whites, so forth and so on. But Larry Doby and Jackie Robinson were accustomed to being around whites. They were accustomed to some of the racial barriers that existed when they traveled with their white teammates, and they knew how to handle adversity. So despite the talent, good or otherwise, Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby were perfect choices.
Okay. And Larry Doby, he went to Cleveland?
Yes, he did. He was from the Newark Eagles. I went directly to Cleveland, whereas Jackie Robinson had to, spend a year in Montreal.
Yeah, in Montreal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And send him to Canada.
So this integration thing started. Did a lot of the Negro leagues then become farm teams for the major leagues in terms of
development? Not at all. No,
not at all.
For a better word, the major leagues just raped the Negro leagues of all their talent. They took their top talent. Sometimes they signed the ball players, sometimes they did not. They just took the top talent, leaving the Negro League teams just a shell, and eventually caused the demise of black teams in the Negro American League.
Did they compensate the owners for the players?
Well, it's interesting. The Brooklyn Dodgers did not compensate J.L. Wilkerson for Jackie Robinson. However, the Cleveland Indians did compensate Effa Manley for Larry Doby. And she was ripped apart in the black press for hindering integration. But she stood her ground saying, Mr. Doby and Mr. Monty Irvin are under contract, and I demand that I be paid for what they are worth. You know, also Don Newcomb and other ball players. I'm not going to give away my ball players just to integrate the sport. We are a professional club, and we will do things in an orderly manner. And I think that, along with many other reasons, is why she's in the Hall of Fame. She stood her ground. And, you know, took a position that the Newark Eagles were a professional club. And she was not standing in the way of integration. She was just doing business as it should be done.
Hello.
And yes.
You know, I'm just listening to what you're saying here and totally agree. And from what you said, yeah, she deserves to be in the Hall of Fame for just for standing her ground, if nothing else.
Right. So she took a lot of hits from the black press. And
and the black press is really was really behind the integration movement, were they not?
Oh, without a doubt. They all the way back to the early 40s, they had many interviews with major league players and owners and coaches saying, if we were to integrate, would you object to a black player on your team? And just across the board, most of them said no. We welcome the black player, especially the talent that we have seen in Josh Gibson and Hilton Smith and others. Unfortunately, the owners disagreed. They felt like they would lose their fan base if they allowed black and whites to play on the same field. And as we found out, they were wrong in that decision. So
there were some financial considerations as well, because, as I understand it, in the little research that I've done, there was a fear that the black ball players would be taking a lot of money away, because the baseball was different. And that is, it was more lively, it was more stepped up. There was a lot of bunting, stealing bases, hit and run kind of plays. That in the Negro Leagues, they played a more exciting brand of baseball. And the owners, particularly Branch Rickey, started noticing the enthusiasm amongst white fans for black baseball.
Yeah, that is so true. Black baseball was more up-tempo, more creative. I mean, they had the bunt and run, the hit and run. If you got a single, you would steal second, go to third on a sacrifice fly, and then come home on a suicide steal play. It was just a more exciting game where the Negro League teams may score a run without getting a base hit. What we see in the 40s, we go back to the East-West All-Star game, they had a higher attendance at the East-West All-Star game than they did in Major League All-Star games. And I'm sure Branch Rickey and Bill Veeck and other Major League owners saw that the Negro League All-Star game is drawing 55,000 people, and Major League All-Star games are not. So this may be more of a financial incentive for people like Branch Rickey and other owners to bring in these black ball players, because they were faster and more acrobatic in turning double plays, and no one could hit a ball like Josh Gibson. And so I think they saw this as a potential gate attraction, and it did work out to their favor. More fans came than ever before. Even the black fans, they turned their allegiance over to their local white teams. They wanted to see how their black men would play on the field against their white counterparts. So they increased their attendance significantly.
I understand another innovation in black baseball was the idea of a bullpen, warming up pitchers. What other innovations was black baseball responsible for that we see today?
Well, one of them goes back to a year before the Yankees start wearing numbers on their uniforms, and the Negro League teams are already doing that. We see in the mid-30s, Willie Wells, after he was beamed by a pitcher, he started to wear a miner's hat and thus created the batting helmet. This is almost 5 years before Major League Baseball teams started to wear batting helmets. We also see, because of the population base, they created nighttime baseball in 1930. This is 5 years before Cincinnati put up stadium lights in Crosley Field. So you see that the Negro Leagues were always on the cutting edge. Back in the 20s, J.L. Wilkerson started Ladies' Day for the simple fact he thought he could cut down on profanity in the ballpark, which worked. So he invited all the ladies in for free. There was less drinking, less profanity, and the ladies started to like the game. And so, in essence, it increased attendance. So other teams, started to have Ladies' Day. And other promotions like Knothole Day, where, you can look through the knothole in the fence and watch the game for free. Always trying to find something to get people into the ballpark.
Okay.
So, you know, the Negro Leagues were like a jazz musician, just creative and innovative.
Okay, improvise. Also, my
yes.
add that Larry Lester is a member of MAGIC, the Midwest Afro-American Genealogical Interest Coalition,
yes.
here in Kansas City. We only have about a minute left, Larry. Why don't you give us your contact information again, your website, and how people can get a hold of you if they want to send a message, if they have a question, want to chat Black baseball or whatever.
Oh, great, of course. Well, they can reach me by email by LarryLester42@gmail.com, and they can also visit my website to see what I do full-time at LarryLester42.com. So I welcome all queries. I love talking to people about Black sports and especially the Negro Leagues.
And around the country, what would you, besides our museum, the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum here in Kansas City, what would be the one site out there as families are traveling around this summer planning their vacations, where would you suggest that they stop to take in some Negro baseball history?
Well, that's a tough one. There's only one Negro League Baseball Museum in the country. The others are in talking stages, but I would definitely check out the African American Museum at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. They have quite a bit of Negro League artifacts there.
Okay. Well, Larry, it's been a blast. It's been informative as always. I really appreciate your taking the time out of your busy schedule this time of year to talk with us about Black baseball, and maybe we'll have to take this up again when spring training starts
of course.
In April or what have you. Thanks again,
I'll
Larry.
I look forward.
Yeah.
I look forward to being
okay.
on your show again, Preston.
Great. Take care.
All right. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, another episode of The Gift of Freedom, brought to you by author and historian Leslie Gist. I've been your host, Preston Washington, and we were talking Black baseball with Larry Lester. Good night, everybody. Take care.